In the past week or so, you may have seen a video from the media blog Deadspin, featuring a mashup of local TV news anchors from stations owned by Sinclair Broadcast Group across the country. All of them shared the same message.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But
we are concerned about trouble and trying to get responsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and
false news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets publish these stories without checking facts first. Unfortunately, some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
In Utah, Sinclair-owned KUTV2 also ran the message, with anchors Shauna Lake and Mark Colbell warning,
"This is extremely dangerous to our democracy."
This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. Critics viewed the message as an echo of President Donald Trump's attack on so-called fake news in the mainstream media, while Sinclair defended it as an ethical promise from journalists to viewers. The video has sparked a conversation about the difference between news and corporate messaging, identifying trustworthy sources of news, and what the role of journalism is in this changing media environment. In the spirit of full disclosure, I should tell you that I'm a journalist, so the way that I consume and digest news might differ from a more casual observer. It's my job to know what's going on so that I can bring that information to you as fairly and accurately as possible. So you, in turn, can take it and decide what to do with it, whether that entails bringing it to the ballot box or your community council meeting or your dinner table. From the Salt Lake Tribune to Deseret News, The Atlantic to National Review, CNN, Fox News, the BBC, and social media, I'm reading and watching and listening to it all to get the fullest picture of what's actually going on. That's how I do it. But what about folks who don't work in a newsroom? I posed the question on social media, what sources do you go to for news, and how do you determine fact from fiction?
My name is Donald Aguirre, and I am a student and also work in the wireless industry. So I don't particularly go to one specific news source. I use a couple of different formats from different places. I frequent NPR. I get the Washington Post. I get Time Magazine and The Week in the mail. And then I also follow along on different podcasts, the NPR 5-Minute Update every hour, The Daily with Michael Barbaro. And I try to also go into places that don't reinforce maybe what I think or my beliefs, but I go and sometimes check out Fox Business News. I actually really respect Shep Smith on Fox. So there's a couple of other places that I go to, PBS NewsHour, as many places as I could probably go to. So I like to see who's saying what and how many are there. Like, so is one outlet saying it? And why is it only one outlet saying it? So I question things and then I go and try and investigate on my own. So like if the AP breaks a story, I also like to see, well, where else is it breaking? Is it breaking at the Washington Post? Is it going to the New York Times? Is Fox also reporting it? CNN also reporting it? When I'm talking about big cable places. But I think one of the best ways to fact check is to use a third party. PolitiFact is a great place, I think, to kind of check up on some of these things. And sometimes I know that it's a good place to go because something I read that I liked or something that I agree with or something that goes along with my beliefs. Sometimes they'll check me too, and they'll tell me, this is half true. It's kind of squishy. So PolitiFact is a good place to go to. Snopes is a good place to go to. The about section of whatever that is that you're reading or where you're consuming. See what they're saying, you know. In a story, are there quotes? Or is it more of an editorial? Are people just writing what they think as opposed to what actually happened? So I look for those things. If somebody's going to say that something happened or that such and such organization said something, well, where's the quote? Who did you get that from? You know, so I like to research that type of stuff. I think it's very important to know where the news is coming from and why it's coming at you, or at least that certain things be known for the person that's digesting that news source. Time Magazine just did a four-page story on Jeff Sessions, and in the middle of the story, they mentioned who owns them, because part of the story had something to do with someone affiliated with the group that owns Time Magazine. So it's definitely good to know, because it helps get rid of any conflicts of interest. It also helps you either whether or not you're going to take something with a grain of salt or a boulder of salt.
So my name is Rebecca Hyde. I am from Salt Lake City. I've been here for 22 years now, and I work in regulatory compliance in a hospital. The sources that I prefer to go to for news are NPR, the Salt Lake Tribune, although there have been some things that I've actually had to double check against the Deseret News with some of their reporting, and CNN. If I need to check on something quickly, sometimes I'll check on CNN. And that's pretty much where I'm looking. I also get some of my news from Facebook, but that's not a trustworthy source, and I always have to double check if I see something there. So the first criteria that I have for determining fact versus fiction in the news that I consume is, one, is coming from a trusted source. And NPR, in general, to me, is a very, very trusted source. If I hear something, though, that I just doesn't sound right, or I just think to myself, you know, I really don't have the whole story here. That can't be the whole story. Then what I do is I'll check with different news outlets. And if that's still not there, I can always check with Snopes. And that's always been my go-to to find out if something is an urban legend or if it looks like it's actual reporting. My criteria really is comparing and looking at different perspectives, but sometimes you're just not sure. And it's interesting to me how then you can see the next day or sometimes even a few hours later, the real story will come out that an image was photoshopped or the story left out key details. And I've become much more wary of what the news says these days. Yes, I think it's extremely important to know where the information is coming from, because any news source can have a bias, and I'm trying to find as minimal of a bias as I can. That's not 100%, but I want to look at that. And then if I am looking at something with a known bias, then it's more easy for me to cross-reference that with another publication that maybe has a different spin to it so that I can balance the two of them out. And that's just important for me to make sure that I'm trying to stay in the middle of the road with my news consumption.
With so much confusion in the media landscape currently, I needed an expert to clear things up. Dave Vergobe is a professor of communication at the University of Utah. He's taught media law and ethics and is the former president of the American Journalism Historians Association. I sat down with Vergobe to talk about the ethics of the Sinclair must-run messages, media consolidation, and fake news.
Well, I define fake news as a phenomenon, not an actuality. It's a created political ploy or tactic. It's highly destructive to the democratic process because it introduces doubt into our news reporting system, and too many people too often forget that journalism is the basis of democracy. It's protected by the First Amendment. It's the only business that's protected by the First Amendment, and the reason is we, the public, must know and be able to question what our government's doing. If you put doubt into that system, then you can warp the system and you can start controlling the system. So I define fake news not in any way as news, but as a phenomenon that is highly detrimental to democracy.
So I ask you about fake news because by now many people have seen the mashup of local news anchors, which featured KUTV anchors Shauna Lake and Mark Colbell, reading a Sinclair-issued statement about fake news. And on its face, the message seems valid, you know, be a conscientious consumer of media. Was this problematic in your opinion?
Oh, yes. It was beautifully crafted by the corporate entity of Sinclair that had nothing to do with the local broadcaster's input or interest. But as I say, beautifully crafted, because how can you disagree with it? We want to uphold democracy. But it's highly problematic because it's actually anti-democratic in the aspect that there were accusations there of other media entities who were delivering fake news and harming the democratic process. And what viewers did not realize, for the most part, is that this same ordered, mandated statement by the anchors was happening all across the country. And it was the exact same message. So it clearly was not a local message. And the other problem with it is it put the anchors in an incredibly troubling and difficult position, because people rely on them as trustworthy in the local market. And of course, what this is doing is undermining them, because I'm sure people thought that these were the words of the anchors, and they weren't the words of the anchors. And it undercuts and undermines their credibility when that is finally realized. The other aspect to it is there were accusations of false news, fake news by other entities, but there was no evidence. The number one thing I say, as all my former students and present one know, is UCC, unsupported claims crumble. And there was no evidence whatsoever as to who these entities were who were supposedly putting out fake news. And of course, they were, these are near defamatory allegations, but they weren't in any way supported. Very problematic for so many different ways, especially when you finally realize that Sinclair has been documented for actually being one of the foremost fake news agencies in the country.
Can you explain in what way?
Yes, what they do is, and they bought up now, I think, 193 stations.
Yes.
And what they will have if their final purchase of the Tribune Company's stations, it will give them upwards of 70% or something like that of the audience in the United States, that all will have the same mandated messages. And that's what Sinclair does, is they have a very specific political viewpoint, and they mandate their stations to run particular stories all across the country. But they come out on the local news agencies, and people think a lot of times they are local news. They aren't, and they do have a particular political bias in them. Now, why this is insidious is because just back in November, the FCC, under Ajit Pai, who was actually an industry worker, who then was put in place of the industry of the broadcasting at the FCC. He's the chair of the FCC. What they did is they rescinded a longstanding rule that you couldn't own more stations than 39% of the U.S. population. And that was argued back and forth for years, and many people have tried to overturn that. The industry has. But a lawsuit back in 2003, Prometheus Broadcasting versus FCC, kept saying the appeals courts that were hearing these cases continually said, if you have a good reason to show us that you're still serving in the public interest, necessity, or convenience, you can change this rule. And they never did that, no matter how many times that they actually attempted to change the rule. But now, just almost instantly, when the new FCC under Pai, they just changed the rule and they opened it broadly. And now this would cover 70% of the national audience. I mean, think about that, 70%.
That's a lot of
almost three quarters of the U.S. population. And the same messages are being mandated at all these local 193 local news stations across the country, when people are actually thinking it's local and coming from local sources, because it's not clarified. I've seen some of the stories that have run. You know, it's not clarified who suddenly these reporters are that you've never seen before appear on your local news channel. So it's that kind of power and control over the message, especially when it's not being performed in the democratic assumption which is why news media are protected by the First Amendment, to assist people with their social, economic, political decision making. And you need straight information on that so you can make that legitimate decision. So if the entity who controls all that message has a particular political bias, and the people who are receiving the message don't even realize this, then yes, you're getting tainted news. And they have been doing this for years. And so for them to come out with this message, which is so beautifully worded in the defense of democracy, it's hypocritical if you understand the actual situation. And it's especially hypocritical because they're doing exactly what they're saying should not be done.
Sinclair, though, is a private company. Do they not have any say in the message that's broadcast?
Absolutely. You can say anything you want. You could take any political position you want. The problem that has occurred with this, and this has been going on many years, but especially since the 2016 presidential campaign and with the administration that's been elected, the biggest problem that really occurs here is the distinction between news, hard news, and editorials. And so many people do not understand or do not make the distinction between what is actually news, factual news information that's being delivered in a straight, hard news manner, and the editorial aspect of it. A perfect example, if we're talking about broadcast television stations, and that's what Sinclair is involved with here, is Channel 2, which is the Sinclair station here in Salt Lake City. For years and years, they would run, and as the other local channels would run, editorials. They would take a position on a particular public issue. But what would happen is it was at the end of the newscast, and it was the station manager, usually, or the news director, who came on, clearly stated who he was, clearly stated this is management's editorial position. And it was very clear to everyone who was listening or watching exactly what this was. This was not a news report. This was an editorial. That's not happening. And that's what needs to happen to make clear this distinction, because people almost instinctually seem to, whatever they hear, if it's branded news in some ways, they don't make the distinction. And it's the responsibility of the news agency to clearly define those distinctions. And it does not matter what form of dissemination you have. A lot of people say, oh, well, the newspapers, they lay it out and they label them. But boy, you can't do that online, or you can't do this with the broadcasters or on radio. Well, of course you can. And that's exactly what must be done.
Dave, you're anticipating every single question I was going to ask you. I guess something that I'm curious about, and you touched on this a little bit, but are there any other examples of media owners breaching that firewall between, you know, funders and the newsroom, getting their message across and passing it off as news?
Oh, yes. I mean, this has happened over the years. I don't have a specific example to give you, but I can give an example of how it often has occurred in the past. Corporations, organizations have for years done things called video news releases. And what the company does, it's actually a public relations tactic. And what the company does is they put together what looks exactly like a news story. They have a news reporter, and it's a particular issue that they're talking about or a topic, and they interview people, and they have video to go along with it, and they tell the story. And then they send these out to different, for example, television stations. And if the TV stations aren't carefully vetting what it is that they're doing, the goal of a video news release is to get this actually placed on air as a story, because it's already packaged, right? And that has occurred. They've run these stories. A legitimate news agency understands what they are. And if it's a good story topic, they'll investigate it themselves and create their own story. But this is not uncommon. The big distinction that we're talking about today here, though, is those corporate entities I'm referring to are the ones who actually are owning the news entities. Now ownership has been corporatized for years and years and years. And you know, back in 1980, there were 50 corporations that owned almost 87% of all the media in the world. Well, at this point in time, it's five major international conglomerates own about 90% of the world's media. And so that level of control is to me, terrifying because they can control the message. And so here it isn't another corporate entity sending to a news agency a video news release. No, it's the corporate entity who owns the news release who is now starting to break that wall that you're talking about, the firewall. And that's a very important point that you're raising here. There always must be between editorial and finance a wall, a firewall, where the money interests are not interfering with the messages if it's a legitimate news agency. And that's always been very, very difficult to do because advertisers,
right.
You know, advertisers, we have to serve our advertisers, and that can interfere with what the message might be. So yeah, you're hitting on an extraordinarily important point here. And has that firewall been breached? Well, yes, many times.
It's happened before. It will probably happen again.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of in that same vein, talking about money and the business of news, it seems to me that there's a parallel to be made here between the situation for a lot of local TV stations and for a lot of local newspapers. You know, a hedge fund or a big corporation like Sinclair treats local news like a revenue generator, and the citizen consumer of news and the journalists, they treat it as something different, as an important part of our democratic society. Do you think that there is a way to reconcile that disconnect?
I don't know. I can give you a little bit greater understanding of how that happened.
Yes, please.
In the broadcasting realm especially is where it really started with when President Reagan's administration came in the 1980s and the massive deregulation across the board for industries. That occurred in the broadcasting as well. Broadcasting was always seen as a trusteeship model, it was called. The public owns the airwaves. We're on the public's airwaves right now. And if the public owns the airwaves, then we have to have some form of regulation of it. Well, who would do that? Well, it's the public's government. We are self-governing, so the governance comes from the government entities. That's why the FCC was eventually created back in 1927, the Radio Act and the 1936 Communications Act, etc. That lasted until the deregulation of the 1980s. And everything that was put into this idea of broadcasting was to serve the interest and convenience and necessity of the public. And it was regulated to the point where multiple messages were mandated. You would have to have all sides of an issue if you're going to talk about the issue to make sure that was honored, that democratic need of the public's airwaves. Well, it changed in 1980, and we're now based on a marketplace model. And through that deregulation, so many of these regulations in broadcasting that mandated public interest, necessity, or convenience were thrown out. In the 1996 Telecom Act, the most recent massive reworking, which was basically written by the industry of broadcasting through lobbyists, the public interest, necessity, or convenience still exists. The phrase, but there's nothing to enforce it, right? And so it's supposedly still there, but it threw out all of the ownership. It changed all the ownership rules. It changed all what you need to do to qualify for license. There were regulations that made it ensured, let me say, that radio and television broadcasting entities were not products. They were something that was integral to our democratic process, and they had to be respected that way. But they are products now, and they're bought and sold. It used to be you couldn't sell your station for 7 or 8 years or something until you established what you were supposed to be doing and someone else could buy it. Now you can turn them over just bam, 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 bam. And it is a money-making proposition. So there definitely is interference. And the difficulty arises is those people, the trust funds, like the hedge fund that used to own the Tribune and all these corporate entities here, we're talking about business people who are interested in business.
In making money.
MBAs, right? And when MBAs control the newsroom, there was a great book written about that years ago, and it's just gotten worse. They don't know or they don't care about the journalistic importance of the Fourth Estate and why they have First Amendment protections. they want to make some money off of this, right? And if we can make more money by catering to our advertisers and not running stories on them, then we'll do that. And that has happened, right?
Is journalism really a good money-making endeavor, though? I don't.
Well, that's what we're finding out right now with the state of newspapers because of the digital revolution, right? So we'll see if people truly understand their civic duties and if they truly want a democracy to live within. If they truly understand what that means, they will truly understand they need legitimate news agencies that can criticize and take on the government and corporations, because that's what journalists are doing, are fighting for that self-governance. And it's supposed to be our knowledge. We should be knowing what the government is doing. It is supposed to be us. And it's the fourth estate outside the three branches of government that are the true watchdogs. But if people don't respect that, they won't pay for it. And we're losing, as you know, papers left and right. And we're losing so many news agencies, and news agencies are reducing their number of reporters and editors and producers. America, wake up.
I feel like I want to leave it there, but I'm hoping you can advise then. As an ethics professor, as a law professor, what should journalists take away from all of this, and what should consumers of news take away from it?
For me, I think the most significant thing is, again, this understanding on the part of viewers, listeners, readers. Know exactly what it is that you're looking at, reading, you're absorbing. What is the type of information? Is it a hard news story? Is it a straight news factual story that's being presented to you? Or is it editorial commentary on an issue? Don't be confused. Be clear. And the news agencies, their ethical responsibility is to ensure that people know that. You mentioned earlier about the comparison between local and national. And what was interesting, you mentioned Fox and CNN, which most people often do. And if we're talking about the cable news presentations on a 24-hour basis with CNN and Fox, it says Fox News, and it's the cable news network. 90% of that is not news. It's commentary on issues of the day, which can give you further background, but it is not the news itself. And you need to be proactive in finding out multiple sources as to what actually is going on, and not confuse what's happening with the talking heads, the screaming heads that you see on cable news networks when it isn't news. It's screaming heads for entertainment purposes, to get an audience, to sell to advertisers. And the best way you can do that is controversy and conflict. But that's not news. And the closest it comes is they might be touching upon a particular issue of the day. But it's not news. So find the news.
Well, hopefully people can, find news here in their local community. That was a shameless plug for KCPW. But Dave Rigobi, a communication professor at the University of Utah, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you for asking.
KUTV News couldn't be reached for comment before this program went to air. How do you vet the news you consume? Weigh in at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.